What are the two unavoidable things in life? According to Benjamin Franklin, they're death and taxes. And then someone added, the only difference between the two is you can cheat on your taxes. Because there is no cheating death. According to one old legend, one day a merchant in Baghdad sent his servant to the market. Before long, the servant came back and he was visibly shaken. And in great agitation, he said to his master, "Down in the market today, I was jostled by a woman. And when I turned, I saw that it was death. And she looked at me and she made a threatening gesture at me. Master, please, lend me your horse. I must escape. I must hide. I want to ride to Samarra. And death will not find me there." The master lent him his horse and the servant galloped away in great haste. Later that same day, the merchant was down in the marketplace and he saw death and went up to her and said, "Why did you frighten my servant this morning? What was this threatening gesture you made?" She said, "That was not a threatening gesture. It was only a look of surprise. I was astonished to see him here in Baghdad, for I have an appointment tonight with him in Samarra." There is no way of escaping or cheating death. Now, there is a third unavoidable reality, though some might argue it doesn't fit with these other two because it occurs after this life. The Bible tells us in Hebrews 9:27, man is destined to die once, and after that to face judgment. I kind of like how the Message paraphrases that phrase. Everyone has to die once, then face the consequences. And it's true. Just as certain as death is to every person who's ever lived, so is the certainty that we will one day stand before God's judgment seat and give an account for ourselves. Now, over the last several weeks, we have been looking at what some have called the trial of all time. The most important trial in human history that happened on what we call Good Friday. The trial of Jesus of Nazareth. And we focused our attention specifically on the presiding judge, the Roman governor Pontius Pilate. See, in the course of that trial, he asked a number of questions, some to Jesus, some to the crowd. And we've seen that these questions are very relevant for us today. None more so than the last question he asked. It's a very simple question, but the ramifications are very significant. And it is a question that every person who has ever lived must answer for themselves. The question is found in Matthew 27, verse 22. Pilate asked, "What shall I do then with Jesus, who is called the Christ?" What shall I do with Jesus? That's a question every one of us must ask and answer for ourselves. You see, Pilate at this point is faced with the inevitable determination. He wanted to solve the problem, but not make any definite decision about Jesus. You see, as the Roman governor, he was pledged to uphold the law. But as a politician, he knew he had to get along with the people. And especially, as we've seen in an earlier message, he was on probation with Rome. He had already gotten into trouble. There were a lot of squabbles with his Jewish subjects. So the spotlight was on him. And he had to try to keep peace. Now, furthermore, it's very plain as you go through the trial of Jesus. Pilate was convinced that Jesus was innocent of the charges against him. He knew this man was not some firebrand, some revolutionary who was out to overthrow the government. He was not all the things that the Jewish leaders tried to accuse him of being. He wanted to release Jesus, but he feared for his career. He was afraid that if he went against the crowd, that they would report back to Rome and he might lose his job. Now you go through this trial, Pilate is vacillating from one side to the next. One minute he's saying, this man's innocent, I'm going to let him go. The next minute he's trying to please the crowd. He can't make up his mind. But you know, that's a lot like people today. A lot of people today, when they have to answer that question, what will I do about Jesus, they waver, they vacillate. They're one way one minute and the other way the next. They can't make up their minds. They know it's right, but what about my friends, my family? What are the guys at work going to say? What are the ladies at coffee going to say? What's going to happen if I take the stand? If I answer that question? It's a very common situation today. But you know that question, what shall I do with Jesus? It's the most important choice anybody will ever make. Because it determines not only the quality of your life now, but your eternal destiny as well. Now, attempting to get out of this predicament, Pilate tried several maneuvers to escape his responsibility. If nothing else, we've got to give credit to Pilate for being creative. Because he tried every trick in the book to not make a decision. And yet, as we will see, these attempts were but ineffective diversions from the true accountability that he had for himself. The first diversion that Pilate tried is recorded in the Gospel of Luke. Luke 23. We read that the Jewish leaders said to him, this man stirs up the people all over Judea in his teaching. He started in Galilee and then came down here. Upon learning that Jesus was a Galilean, he sent him to Herod Antipas, who was at Jerusalem at the time, because Herod had that jurisdiction. Pilate thought, ah, perfect. I can get rid of this case. This is a brilliant move by Pilate. By sending Jesus to Herod, he's getting rid of this sticky case, which he really didn't want to have anything to do with. And at the same time, he was mending fences with a political foe. In fact, if you keep reading in Luke, verse 12 says, that day Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they'd been enemies. In today's political terms, he was reaching across the aisle. He was mending fences with the other party. And he thought, this is brilliant. This is going to work. In judicial terms, this is called a change of venue. You will even hear about this sometimes in the news. A defense attorney will try to do this. He'll try to have the trial move to another county, to another jurisdiction. Why? Because maybe the local press has covered the crime so much, they're afraid they can't get a fair trial. They're thinking that all of the prospective jurors will have already been prejudiced before the trial even begins. Now, in psychological terms, this is called passive avoidance. Rather than dealing with the issue directly, Pilate is trying to evade the problem without making any choice. When both sides have a cost, we try to get away from it. We think if we evade it or ignore it, maybe it'll go away. Never does, does it? Now, in spiritual terms, I call this bypassing. We're not in a position to send Jesus elsewhere, so we move ourselves. We steer clear of television or radio programs that confront us with uncomfortable truth. If the church we attend doesn't preach what we want to hear, we'll change churches. And trust me, if you look hard enough, you will find a church that tells you exactly what you want to hear. Paul told us this in 2 Timothy 4, verses 3 and 4. He says, the time will come when men will not put up with sound doctrine. Instead, to suit their own desires, they will gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. They will turn their ears away from the truth and turn aside to myths. Folks, that day is now. You can get on television, you can listen to the radio, you can drive down the street and find a church that's going to tell you exactly what you want to hear. You ever wonder why some of the churches, not all, but why some of the churches that are so big, why they're so big? Some of them is because they tell people what they want to hear, not what they need to hear. And it's very easy for people today, just like Pilate, to bypass the truth, to try to get away from it. He tried to send the truth away from him. We can't do that, so we send ourselves away from the truth. But you know what? It doesn't work. Didn't work for Pilate because Herod sent Jesus back to him. And it doesn't work for us either because we cannot evade the responsibility we all have. The second diversion Pilate tried, I call bargaining. And Pilate actually tried this twice. We're told in John 19 that Pilate had Jesus flogged. Now, that's a term we don't use much anymore. It's a concept that is foreign to our culture, thankfully. But back in those days, it was very common. And in fact, there were three different kinds of flogging. One was a light flogging that was kind of meant as a warning. Then there was a little bit more serious one, and then there was a very severe flogging that there were some victims that didn't even survive that. And I won't get into all the gory details of that. And it's hard to say which one John's talking about here. Likely he's talking about the first, a light beating, just to please the crowd. He said, wait a minute. I thought Pilate thought Jesus was innocent. I mean, that'd be like somebody in a courtroom today where the judge says, I find you innocent, but I'm going to put you in jail for a year. What's that all about? It's not fair for Pilate to have Jesus flogged when he was innocent of the crimes. And that's true, but he was trying to elicit sympathy. He was trying to compromise. He was trying to bargain with the crowd. Well, I'll punish him halfway. Now I don't have to punish him all the way. That didn't work either. Because now the crowd just was all the more insistent that Pilate put him to death. Doesn't work for us either. We can't bargain with God. We can't elicit sympathy from God because we give up something for Lent. It doesn't work that way. We can't try to say, okay, God, if I do this, is that going to be acceptable? Because I really don't want to have to do that. We cannot negotiate terms with God. He only accepts absolute surrender. But we try. We try to bargain. Then Pilate tried another bargain, a choice between Jesus and Barabbas. You see, during this time of year, the Roman governor would release a prisoner that his subjects called for. But they had to make the choice. He couldn't decide which prisoner to release. So he thought, I know what I'll do. I'll offer them Jesus, and then I'll offer them the most heinous criminal I have. A guy named Barabbas. These days we would call him a terrorist. That's what he was. He was a murderer. And he didn't murder Romans. He murdered his own people who didn't go along with him. If you didn't believe how Barabbas believed, the price was on your head. That's the kind of person Barabbas was. And so Pilate thinks, here, I've got an idea. I'll give the people a choice. I'll give them an alternative. But once again, it didn't work. You see, the more Pilate tried to wriggle out of his predicament, the more entangled in the web he became. It just got worse. They say, well, how do people do that today? Try to make bargains with God all the time. You even see it in the New Testament. People would come to Jesus and say, I want to follow you. And he'd say, well, go sell all you have and then you can follow me. No, I don't want to do that. Another came and said, I'll go with you wherever you go. And he said, you realize I'm homeless? You realize that I don't have a place even to lay my head? Another said, let me go back and say goodbye to my family. He said, anyone who looks back is not worth following me. You say, wow, those are pretty tough statements, Jesus. Don't you want people to follow you? I'm always amazed at how different Jesus is than many of the preachers today are. Preachers today will do anything they can to get a big crowd. They'll market. They will advertise. They'll do all these things short of standing on their head to get people to come to church. And the bigger the better. I tell you what, you get a group of preachers together, I guarantee you, if it's not the first thing that they talk about, sometime they're going to get around to, so how big is your church? How many people do you have coming on Sunday? Why? Because that's a measure of success. You know, Jesus wasn't like that. Jesus would get a huge crowd. He'd have thousands of people following, and he would say something and a whole bunch of them would leave. He would say something like, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life in you. And they're like, ugh, I'm going somewhere else. He would drive church growth experts today crazy. What are you doing, Jesus? What Jesus was doing was finding out those who really wanted to follow Him, as opposed to those who are playing religious games. And there's a lot of folks trying to play religious games. They think they can bargain with God. Okay, God, I'm going to go to church on Sunday. I might even put some money in the plate. I'll do a good deed. I'll read my Bible. I'll pray. Now just leave me alone the rest of the time. God says, no. It doesn't work that way. God is not Monty Hall. This is not let's make a deal. We cannot bargain with God. Listen to Jesus' ultimatum. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Any one of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple. You say, what, we're supposed to hate our family now? Jesus was saying, your commitment to me needs to be so great that by comparison it's like you hate your closest family. That's the kind of commitment Jesus calls us to. Jesus says, there can be nothing in your life more important than me. That's a big commitment. And he will not negotiate. He will not bargain. As A.W. Tozer put it well, Christ will either be Lord of all or he will not be Lord at all. And there is no ground in between. Now the third diversion Pilate tried is blaming. What's the one enduring image we have of Pontius Pilate on Good Friday? Washing his hands, right? After he realized that he couldn't bargain with the crowd, he couldn't bypass his authority, he said, bring me out a basin of water. And he made a big show of washing his hands. And he says, I am innocent of this man's blood. He's your responsibility. Let me ask you, did washing his hands absolve Pilate of his responsibility? Not at all. He was still responsible for his decision. Now, this washing of hands, it was actually a Jewish custom. And Pilate was doing something that his Jewish subjects could relate to. They understood what it meant to wash the hands of responsibility. It goes all the way back to Deuteronomy. But it didn't work. It didn't work any more then than it did the first time that people tried blaming. You know when that happened? The Garden of Eden. You got to go all the way back to the very beginning, right? Adam and Eve, you know, there's the tree of the garden, or the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Don't eat from it. They did. God comes along. Adam, what did you do? You know what he said? The woman you put here with me. Notice that. He not only blames Eve, he blames God. You put her here. And she gave it to me. Right? And then God says to Eve, what happened here? The serpent! Now, give Eve credit. She didn't say, the serpent you made. She didn't blame God, but she was trying to blame the snake. And ever since, you've had marriage counseling needed, right? Try to blame somebody else. I mean, you know what? You know what all psychology boils down to? Secular psychology boils down to one phrase. It's not your fault. Ever notice that? Oh, there's lots of schools of thought in psychology, but it all comes down to one thing. It's not your fault. Blame your parents. Blame your grandparents. Blame the environment. Blame Violence on video games. Blame this, blame that. I'm not trying to get political here, but I saw a little cartoon I thought was great. Someone said, guns cause violence, spoons make us fat. Why not? That's the idea. We can't take responsibility for ourselves. We've got to blame somebody or blame something. Blame the spoon because it's making me fat. It's a very common diversion, but it doesn't work. It didn't work for Pilate. Doesn't work for us. Why didn't it not work for Pilate? Why couldn't Pilate just blame it on the Jews? Because there was only one man on that day who could say the words, "Let him be crucified." And his name was Pontius Pilate. If Pilate had not said those words, Jesus would not have died on the cross. But he did. And he bears the responsibility for what he did. You see, he asked the crowd, "What shall I do with Jesus?" But only he could answer it. And his answer was, "Let him be crucified." And Pilate is responsible. And what's true then is still true today. We bear responsibility for ourselves. The one thing no man can ever rid himself of, and that's responsibility. Bypassing, bargaining, blaming, Pilate tried them all. But they all proved to be ineffective diversions when it came to that question, "What shall I do with Jesus?" And they're still ineffective today. As Warren Wiersbe writes, "Every decision Pilate made forced him to make another decision until he was a prisoner of his own evasions." And you know, that's true people today too. People are so messed up inside because they keep trying to avoid the issue. They run from their problems. They think if I move away, all my problems will stay there. You know what? You're bringing your problems with you. You can't run away from them. We try bargaining with God, and God says, "I'm not into the bargaining business. I want all of you or none of you." We try blaming somebody else, but it all comes back to us. It all comes back to the decision each one of us must make. And so Pilate is faced, as are we, with the inescapable decision. What would he do with Jesus? He had to do something because he was the judge and only he could determine the fate of the accused. He thought he could avoid making the choice. He thought he could bypass the decision. He thought he could strike a bargain with the crowd. He thought he could blame the mob and wash his hands of it. But in the end, he had to make a choice. And even in not making a choice, he was making a choice. And we too face that same inescapable decision. No, we're not in the position of a presiding judge, but each one of us must decide for ourselves whether to follow Jesus or to go our own way. There is no neutrality. There is no alternative. There is no third choice. We cannot merely say, "Oh, he's a nice man." Some of you may know the name C.S. Lewis. He was an atheist scholar back in the 1930s and 40s who became an outspoken Christian advocate. And he puts it in no uncertain terms. "I am trying here to prevent anyone saying that really foolish thing that people often say about Jesus. I'm ready to accept him as a great moral teacher, but not his claim to be God. That is one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with a man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else he's a madman or something worse. You can shut him up as a fool. You can spit on him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about him being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to." Jesus either was the Son of God or he wasn't. If he wasn't, he either knew that he wasn't, and that makes him a liar, not a good teacher. If he really thought he was, but he wasn't, that makes him a lunatic, not a very good moral teacher there either. or he was who he says he was, and that makes him Lord. Those are the only options there are. And we must decide. Now, our deciding doesn't make it fact. We can deny that Jesus was God. We can deny Jesus existed. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. What it does is it seals our fate. Because our fate is determined by how we answer that question. And we must decide for ourselves. And there's only two options. We can either crown Him as King of our lives, or we can crucify Him as history's ultimate fraud. Like Pilate, the ball is back in our court. No pun intended. We have to make a decision. It's inescapable. The difference, though, between our decision and Pilate's is whose fate is sealed. You see, Pilate's decision sealed Jesus' fate. Our decision seals our own fate. And one day, Jesus will return. But this time, the roles will be reversed. When Jesus came the first time, He had to stand before Pilate. When He comes back, Pilate's going to stand before Him. And so is everybody else who has ever lived. And the question will also be reversed. The question will not be, what shall I do with Jesus? It'll be too late then. The question will be, what will Jesus do with me? As we close, I want to share a true story about this very verse, this very passage of Scripture that we're considering today. Many of you have heard the name D.L. Moody. He was an evangelist in the late 1800s up in the city of Chicago. The Moody Bible Institute is named after him. One evening, on October the 8th, 1871, he preached in Chicago's Farwell Hall. That night, he addressed one of the largest crowds of his career. And his message was the same as mine. Our eternal destiny depends on how we answer the question, what shall I do with Jesus? That was his whole sermon. And at the conclusion of the sermon, Moody told the crowd, I wish you would take this question home with you. Turn it over in your minds. Next week, come back and we'll answer the question, what shall I do with Jesus? And then he invited his song leader to lead in the closing song. But you know that song never finished. Before that man finished the song, they could hear the sirens blaring because the great Chicago fire had begun. And that fire swept through the city, and many of those same people in that crowd died that night. They didn't have another week to decide what to do with Jesus. Their decision was made when they took their last breath. 22 years later, on the anniversary of the fire, Moody again spoke from that passage of Scripture. And he said this, what a mistake. I remember Ira Sankey singing and how his voice rang, today the Savior calls, for refuge fly. The storm of justice falls and death is nigh. Those are the words he was singing when the sirens went off for the great Chicago fire. Moody goes on, I have never seen that congregation since. I have hard work to keep back the tears today. 22 years have passed and I have not seen that congregation since, and I will never meet those people again until I meet them in another world. But I want to tell you of one lesson I learned that night which I've never forgotten, and that is when I preach, to press Christ upon the people then and there to try to bring them to a decision. You will notice that Pilate was in just the condition of my audience that night. Just in the condition you are today. He had to decide then and there what to do with Jesus. I have asked God many times to forgive me for telling people that night to take a week and think it over. I have never dared to give an audience a week to think of their salvation since. This morning we're going to close our service with a different hymn, one that captures this question of Pilate for today. The most significant question we will ever answer is this, what shall I do with Jesus? And I want you to notice, turn in your hymnal, hymn number 304. I want you to notice the words of the chorus. What will you do with Jesus? neutral you cannot be. Someday your heart will be asking, what will He do with me? And this morning I present to you that question. Don't put off making a decision. By not deciding, you're deciding against Him. And when that day comes and you stand before Jesus as the judge, it'll be too late. You must decide before then. And if you haven't already, I implore you, make that decision today. What will you do with Jesus? We're going to sing the first verse, and we're going to sing the third. If you've never made that decision, but you want to, you want to say, Jesus, be my Lord, be my Savior. I want the blood You shed on the cross to wash my sins away. I commit myself to You. If you've never done that, but you want to, I'm going to ask you to come and stand with me up here in the front, that all of us might pray for you and pray with you, and you can begin a new life today. If you haven't made that decision, don't put it off. We don't know how long we've got. And if we wait too long, it will be too late.